Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Shalom, hubba hubba. This is Kimberly Chow.
And I'm Amanda Dell.
We're a food book fair, and this is Recommended Reading on Heritage Radio Network. We're coming to you live today from the back of Roberta's Pizza at Heritage Radio Network, and we will be joined later by our very special guest, Julian Richards, a dear friend, veteran photo agent, decorative brontosaurus of Table on 10.
That lady out there is picking food out of her teeth with the side of her check.
Julian is already in the building.
And you know what? She has no idea that we can see.
We told you that you can't really see. Or we give the illusion.
They can't see in? Man.
It's tinted.
I want to go out and tell her.
It's tinted.
All right, keep going.
If you ever come on our radio show, guys, or if you're at Roberta's and you're sitting at the table that's right next to the Heritage Radio booth, don't apply your makeup. Don't pick stuff out of your teeth, because if Julian's here or someone
he's gonna call you on that.
So
don't
just
play
be
with
aware.
Yourself. Wear
it's a,
underwear.
It's a two-top.
Definitely so wear underwear, because I can. I'm looking.
Be aware.
We're looking at everything.
Yeah.
But before we get into more of that, unless Julian runs out to take that lady's check out of her teeth,
she's gone.
Amanda and I are going to ask each other what we're reading, watching, and listening to kick off the show. Amanda, what are you reading?
Thanks, Kim. Julian, there's no laughing.
That was a very smooth transition.
There's no laughing on recommended reading, by the way. So stop.
I'm reading funny stuff.
Well, first I'll start off by talking about a book that somehow passed me by, but I can't remember where I was reading about it, but it's like the next up in my queue as soon as I get it. It's written by a man named Shep Gordon. And it's the name of the book is They Call Me Supermensch. And I guess Shep Gordon is like an OG talent manager and did a lot of stuff with musicians, but also was kind of the person that was credited with creating like a quote unquote TV chef. So I have this book on order and I'm very, very anxiously awaiting it. And I'm really hoping that I get to dive into it, this weekend. I mean, I'm obsessed with mensches in general. And then this person's a super mensch. I've never heard that category before. So
easy.
I'm enthralled. I want to be enthralled by this book. So I can't wait for that to arrive and to start reading it. If anyone's listening out there and they have read this book, they like it, they want to talk about it, tweet at us at Food Book Fair, share photos of the book on Instagram and tag us. And I want to know kind of what everyone thought of this book, and then maybe next week I'll weigh in on it.
Or you could just not read it if they all.
That will never happen. I will read it. I've already put my mind to it, so I have to read it.
Kim, what are you reading?
I'm reading too much and
Kim,
not the mood by Durga Chubose.
Are you worried about Julian like taking our job? I am.
Julian has his.
That's a laugh track.
Julian has his own radio show. Thank you, DJ Dave, in the booth with us today. Julian has his own radio show in upstate New York, broadcasting out of Roxbury.
That's true.
Called The Evening Tickler.
It is. What are you reading?
What am I reading?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's already got another radio show job. But if it,
I'm scared.
I'm heading off in that direction in a few minutes.
I'm reading Too Much and Not the Mood by Durga Chuboz, which is a book of essays by a writer that I've admired for a long time. And I'm now obsessed with her. I hope she's listening or maybe not listening. But there's this incredible, the first essay, it's like 80 pages long, and it's called Heart Museum. And there's this one scene about her relationship with a best friend and the walks that they go on, and they get their auras photographed in Chinatown. And there's this one particular moment where she remembers a bright green pea soup. And that is sort of the locus for other parts of that sense memory. And I will read a little bit of it.
You're going to read?
I'm going to read a little bit.
I would have brought some dirty limericks with me.
You can still look some up.
Yeah.
But in the meantime.
My own.
Come up with one now.
So one Monday afternoon, when my friend had a day off, we ambled from Midtown to Magic Jewelry, stopping on the way for pea soup. A detail I cannot forget because the pea soup was bright, bright green. Unnaturally so. It's something we both noticed and continued to address with each spoonful, because even the deepest friendships are liable to remark on the color of soup. Green, we said as if it were slime. Delicious goo that seemed to establish our day as one to remember, because from now on, bright green reminds me of the soup, which reminds me of my friend's gold dress that she was wearing with black tights, and how somewhere on Canal we dropped a letter for another friend in a freshly painted mailbox, and how later my friend ordered apple-flavored sorbet and me tiramisu. And at night, we ate a box of Thin Mints while she read my tarot, and then, as it happens, we talked about a boy who was once in a band.
Hmm.
I love it. Have we ever eaten anything that green together?
Anything what? That green?
Yeah.
Salad at Roberta's.
It is pretty green these days.
Hey, did you enjoy your pasta that we had just before?
It was delicious.
It was good?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's good.
It was
al dente.
It was very al dente. Really specifically al dente, yeah? Yeah, okay. That was good.
Yeah. That's what I'm reading right now, and I'm just churning through.
Wow. Well, I have one other.
It's food specific, it looks like.
It is pretty food specific, considering the word food is plastered in large letters right on the front cover.
Tell us about it.
It is the latest issue of the Village Voice, which is the food issue. So the Village Voice, it's still so exciting to me because it's completely free. So this is some, this particular issue is all about food, and what you want to do is look for those like red boxes on the street corners. If you don't know, now you know. Those contain the Village Voice, and it's a completely free newspaper. There's so many things about this issue that I thought were great. One, I thought this front cover was totally rad, and I'm almost positive it was shot by our friend Noah Fex, because I think he shot some of the inside of it as well, and it is of Chef April Bloomfield and the other chef owners of White Gold, the butcher shop on the Upper West Side. So there's an article about them. There's a really cool article about the best bodegas in New York with also some beautiful photography, like bodegas that make their own paletas and have their own regional specialties based on, where they are in New York. So I thought that was super neat.
Who makes their own paletas?
All right, you're going to make me flip through. That wasn't the part I was going to talk about.
You weren't ready, were you?
But I'm not ready. But
you got to remember that detail.
Maybe you should take your question back or ask a different one.
Okay, it's called... It's called Slay Deli. It's spelled S-L-E-Y. So, I mean, hey, Slee.
Mm.
Seems like they slay.
Where is it?
It's in Fort Hamilton Parkway, Brooklyn.
Mm.
It says, these Mexican popsicles are made in small batches in the back of the family-run bodega and distributed throughout the year to other stores around the city. Pineapple and mango versions are given a slightly spicy, smoky complexity with the help of added chilies. So, I mean, and the packaging is just so unique and cool. So if you're ever up in that way in Brooklyn at Slay Deli, they're clearly slaying the paletas game. But the one other part that I wanted to read about this issue, just try to pick it up. Find this red box on the street corner and get your Village Voice.
I love that Amanda Dell is talking about the analog on internet radio.
Totally. You know, I appreciate the digital, but also love the analog.
Well, radio is the vinyl of social media.
So
you can quote me on
that.
You can quote
me on that. All right, that's quotable.
Hey, I might have just come up with that.
Hey. I'm just waiting for that.
Really?
There's going to be a lot of applause and laugh track on the show.
Why is he listening?
that's his job, Julian.
Oh, right.
There is an article about Chef Angie Marr and Beatrice Inn that was written by our friend Jamie Feldmar I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. And, you know, Chef Angie, if you're out there, we'd love to have you on the show one time. I really enjoyed getting this inside take on, one, how you kind of accepted the job at Beatrice Inn, what that was about, and then eventually how you bought out the partners and how you're making it your own. So this was the part that I really loved when she was asked about, you know, essentially that some of the former partners or other people that were involved kept asking her to be a part of the restaurant, and she really didn't want to. So she said, "I didn't want the job," says Marr. "I called my good friend, famed meat distributor Pat LaFreda, and said, 'No one wants this restaurant, and they keep calling me. If I do this, it's career suicide.' He told me I'd be crazy if I did and crazy if I didn't. His point was that if I could come in and turn the place around, it would make my career." So that just, you know, made me think about hard decisions, what it takes, and having, you know, kind of having that long view a little bit and taking a leap of faith. So anyway, pick up this issue of the Village Voice. You can read, you know, all about Beatrice Inn, or as Angie likes to call it, the B. So hope maybe we'll run into you guys at the bar at Beatrice Inn one day.
Also makes me think of why anyone would ever get into this industry.
It is pretty crazy.
We'll talk a little bit about that, as well as politics, pleasure, the raft of the Medusa.
Why people get into the food industry?
Yeah. Well, there'll be some shit talking after the break. But first, the break.
Oh, there's a break?
Yeah.
So
we got to pay the bills around here, Julian.
Okay.
We got to get people to head over to heritageradionetwork.org. And what you want to be looking for is that beating heart. And Julian, we talked a lot about hearts before. If you click on the beating heart at heritageradionetwork.org, you can make a donation, keep shows like Recommended Reading and other fabulous shows on heritageradionetwork.org by pledging and making that donation.
What's that, the break?
It hasn't happened quite yet.
Do you want me to sing something?
I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hello, welcome back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We are live coming at you from Heritage from Heritage Radio Network out of the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. We're here with Julian Richards, veteran photo agent, wayward restaurateur.
Antique. Yes.
Community radio host.
Oh, yeah.
Poetry lover.
Yes.
Opera buff.
It's all true.
Traveler.
Yes.
Julian, you really need to learn how to form an opinion. I mean, just speaking to you for...
You mean I'm extremely opinionated? Hey, you know what? I mean, there are not enough opinions. You know, there are not enough opinions out there. Well, you know what? There's all kinds of opinions. But, you know, you need a well-placed opinion. We need more well-placed opinions. Being opinionated is not such a terrible thing, is it?
Not at all.
How about being opinionated and trying to be funny and then being prepared to say, well, my opinions might all be wrong? Which I'm not prepared to say.
You're not.
But I mean, that would be a generous form of being opinionated.
I do think you're pretty funny.
Well, that's nice. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to get into some of what we've told our listeners that we would say we would get into. But first, maybe we should ask you what you're reading.
Well, you know what? Reading.
Or watching or listening to.
You know, I do a lot less reading than I once did because there was a point in my life where a lot of drama went down.
Mm.
And at that point, I'd always read a lot of fiction and stuff up until that point. And at that point, I found that the drama of my own life was outweighing the drama that I was writing. Like, I wasn't able to actually invest in anybody else's fictional story because the pressing nature of my non-fictional story was so pressed against the inside of my cranium that there was no space for anybody's stupid half-baked storyline. And so I got out of the habit of reading fiction. And then I never really got back into the habit. What have I been reading? I've been reading all about Auschwitz.
Sounds uplifting.
Yeah.
Laugh track, Dave?
No, because me and my daughter went and did this whole journey.
Can you tell us about that?
I can, yeah. I was just about to. We went and did this whole journey where we found this girl. My daughter's 18 years old, so it's a final year project in a tiny little school where she has six people in her grade in the middle of the Catskills. And so she decided she was going to do the story on this girl, Vitorina Levy, who was, Venice has the first ghetto that ever existed. And she was deported from the ghetto in 1943 and shipped to a camp in Emilia-Romagna called Fossoli and then taken to Auschwitz. And then her story vanished completely. So, but she was exactly the same, not exactly the same age. She was 18 and Winnie's 18. So we decided that we'd try and dig that story back up and then follow her journey, the exact journey that she did on the same train tracks and on the same dates.
Wow.
Which we did. So I had to do lots and lots of reading about Auschwitz, but not even necessarily. It was actually really academic reading because there's so little information because the Nazis burned all the information, all the personal records when the camp was being liquidated or before the camp was being liquidated. So we had to go in and find out all this information. We found all kinds of strange stuff. Like she was on, you know, the Italian Jews weren't rounded. Italy didn't round up its Jews until the Germans took over. So they're all rounded up together. So the first train out of Fossoli, I can't remember which train it was or whatever, but the first train out of Fossoli had all of these, had Primo Levi on it. And the beginning of If This Is a Man, which is his, you know, his seminal book, describes this whole thing. And then we're looking at Vitorina's story or whatever, and then we realize she's on exactly the same train. So we're able to transpose his story onto hers. And so when he describes arriving at the Brenner Pass and all this kind of stuff, we're like, well, she's in the next carriage down or whatever. And all the numbers of how many people survived in his. So that's at the beginning, she's literally arm in arm with Primo Levi. At the end, we actually found out an odd thing about her at the end. But in the end, her sister, only two of her and her sister got taken into the camps. And the rest of her family were immediately dead. But at the end, her sister did the death march to the trains that took her to Bergen-Belsen, which is exactly what Anne and Margot Frank did. So they started arm in arm with Prima Levi and ended up arm in arm with Margot and Anne Frank, the two iconic figures of the Holocaust.
So
fun, huh?
Yeah. What was the final presentation that your daughter had to create for this project?
She did she did some written stuff, but then she also did a little movie.
Oh, wow.
So we're filming as we went all the way around. And you know what? It was amazing. It was a hoot. It really was. It was a blast. Because it was, because the process of discovery and the process of the kind of Agatha Christie side of being like, oh my God, I found this, is so exciting and exhilarating. And also you're having to go to places that, you know, I mean, when you're a tourist or whatever, you look at the book and you're like, oh, it says there's a really good restaurant in this town, so maybe we should go there. And you've got that listless quality of like, you know, tourism is all about breakfast, lunch, and dinner and ticking some boxes or whatever.
Right.
This is taking us to weird little towns where, you know, with scrubby bushes, having to stay across, like nobody's going to go there. So the whole process is immediate and exciting and it's amazing. And also a super bonding experience between father and daughter.
Yeah, how fun would that be to get to do?
It was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. We met David and Paul in Krakow, and they came to Auschwitz and Birkenau with us. We had a hoot.
That sounds amazing. I want to go back to one thing, which I think will.
I recommend Holocaust tourism.
Heard it here first.
I could probably write the book.
You've recommended it to me before.
I have.
Heard it
oh my God,
first.
Yes. It's my second Auschwitz trip. I've got a whole. No, you're going to speak.
It's okay. I like this.
That's girls giggling.
We just lost about half of our listeners. This keeps happening every week.
I wish more girls would giggle. I wish that was a response that generally when I spoke would happen. Girls giggling.
We'll work on that.
Can you just have like the Greek chorus follow me around and giggle?
David should just follow you around.
And giggle?
Your own purple. No, your own. Your
that
own
might be weird.
A little
that
quiet
might be a little
storm
weird.
Giggle button.
Might have to call the police.
Uh-oh. I think when you said your daughter is in a class with only six other students.
I think there's six, yeah.
So I think we should back up for a minute and let our listeners know that Julian lives in a very small town in the Catskills called Bovina.
That's true.
And
small town, but now big reputation.
Well, what contributed to that?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it was really.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
What contributed to it? I think more recently, you know, the Catskills were always there, and it was always, you know. It's quite a long way away. It's 3.5 hours. So
from New York City.
Yeah. So, you know, realistically, there was always a kind of barrier of just pure time and attrition.
Right.
Whether you would go or not. I don't know. You know, something happened connected with the food. Of course, inevitably connected with the food movement. Because we've all been up there doing our own thing and a bunch of freaks in this kind of peculiar orbit around New York City. But kind of out of reach. I mean, really, even 3 years ago, if you'd mentioned Bovina, I was driving around Park Slope today, and I saw two of those cars with a BOV sticker.
Seriously?
Yeah. I mean, we've become... Everybody knows about it, I think. So, I don't know. Something happened. You know, there'd been a lot of people doing their own freaky things up there for a long time. I think maybe it was kind of galvanized by the food movement a little bit. I mean, it kind of was... Table on 10 a little bit, and that going, that and a couple of other people maybe projecting a story. I think one thing that hadn't happened up there before is there's a lot of people cooking, there's a lot of people, you know, doing these things that could have been potentially available to people in the city, but there wasn't a whole lot of storytelling going on about it. You know, they were just doing it.
What made you move up there? How did you first find out about Bovina? What caused you to, you know, what was your motivation?
It was an accident. I mean, I moved up, I rented a couple of places because we wanted to move out. You know, that was still at the time of life when people were trying to rent places in the Hamptons.
And this was about 20 years ago.
About 20 years ago. About when we first started renting, yeah. And then, suddenly I had a little bit of money and I realized that I could buy something. And me and Juliet... And the site, you know, we could have bought a one-bedroom apartment in the city or something, but there was some idea that it would just be more exciting to buy something weird in the middle of nowhere that would make you, that wouldn't fit into your life, but would make you move around your life in a different way. And so this house came up in Bovina. I'd never even heard of Bovina. We'd drawn a line at Margaretville, which is, you know, two towns before Bovina. And somebody sent us there, and then we bought it. But, you know, we didn't know anybody. As far as I knew, it turns out not to be the case. But as far as I knew, there was us and a bunch of kind of grizzled guys with beards, and, you know, that was it. That wasn't the case. There were people hidden, but we didn't see them.
What did they make of you and when you arrived?
You know, there was nothing. There was nothing aggressive. They were, eye rolling, I would say.
Okay, and then there was a shift because you moved there full time. So talk to us about that. And
there's a shift in terms of their perception of us when I did.
Meant that you. It started as a second, escape, then something changed because you moved there full time.
That's the process that happens. Yeah, because I think, you know, it's obviously at that distance away, there's a certain amount of schizophrenic quality, but you know, by the time you don't even unpack your bags when you arrive up there or when you come back down, because you know you have to pack them again and turn around and go back. And you know, two cats and a dog and one kid, then two kids, and you know, the Subaru is like just a giant fart of dog cat baby. And so at a certain point you make a decision. You know, I think probably there was a little drop off, financial drop off somewhere along the line. But also just sick of running to and fro. And we'd both lived in cities for a long time, and we'd never done that other thing. And also we had enough of a romantic attachment to what it might feel like. Because when you're only up there on the weekends, you're freaking out on Sunday night because you don't want to go back to the city. So you're like, well, what if we didn't have to go back to the city? And I did a job that I could do remotely. And, you know, you see the kids going up to the barn and running back down a hill and the chickens and they've got eggs in their hands and all that stuff. And you're like, oh, man, this is it. Little did we know, but it's not actually a painting. I mean, it appears to be a painting.
It's actually the Raft of the Medusa.
It's actually
it's
the Raft of the Medusa.
It's a different painting than you thought it would be.
Anybody who knows me who just heard the Raft of the Medusa is like, oh no, he's not going to
again.
Not going to do that whole fucking Raft of the Medusa
Bruegel,
analogy
it's
again. Oh, it is Bruegel too. It's what's that painting? Netherlandish proverbs. It's totally there, with the ass sticking out of the window, with a poo coming out of it, and the thing, and somebody's killing this on the floor, and somebody's fucking that thing, or whatever. It's totally there. Every corner of the canvas is covered with somebody doing all. You know what? Should I stop? Should I? Have I completely taken over?
Keep going.
That's why we invited you on the show.
Keep going.
All right, but what was I going to say? I was going to say, oh yeah. One thing that you don't anticipate, I think, moving up to a remote place like that is that, you know, the full range of human emotion and experience has to come out. You know, I mean, you're going to have to do it all.
And that was dormant, being in the city.
No, in the city it was happening too.
Okay.
All I'm saying is, like, in some way, in the process of going up there, you think because it's a smaller, quieter, more spread out, more peaceful environment, maybe some of the throbbing maelstrom of what it is to be a functional human being and the kind of human beings mm-hmm. that we are will be eased back. Maybe that's part of the reason you even go. You're like, you know what? I'm sick of my brain being pressed against the inside of my skull. Maybe if I went up there, it would shrink down a little bit and I would just enjoy the air coming over and I would suddenly start bird spotting and, you know, taking a nice swim. That doesn't happen. You're still the person that you are. So you're still in there being like, who do I love? Who am I going to be? What is the story? Why am I going to die? What the hell is this all about? Or whatever. So you got all of that, but you've got it in this kind of wide open environment with very few answers.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you go out and shoot something or shoot one of your children or your wife or do whatever. So it's intense. And that's not what you thought you were going for. You thought you were going to mitigate intensity. But actually, you find that you're standing up there. Or I found, and this is me. Other people might disagree with it, but they'd be wrong. But I found that the high-intensity shriek wasn't lessened. I'm still the same person. I'm still like, you know what I mean? But that was intense because now you don't have the interstitial material. You don't get onto the subway and bang into people in some shoulders or whatever. That just wears the day off and takes some of the edges off the existential, the constant state of existential crisis. That's taken away just by like having to navigate up and down some stairs and someone shouting at you and having to get a sandwich or whatever. You don't have that. You're like the compassionate Buddha, but you're not Buddha. And after a certain amount of time, you're not compassionate either. You're just kind of freaking out. And then shit starts to go wrong, potentially. I mean, for most people. Because we don't make... You can chip in at any stage and stop me. But we don't make second... we didn't have backup plans. Mm-hmm. You know, we went up there like innocent children. Like lambs to the slaughter, you know? And you don't make backup plans. So you go up there and you're like, this works if I'm married to you, if my kids are in the beds upstairs, if this whole, you know, if the dog is doing that, this all makes sense as long as we can put this bell jar over it, mm-hmm. and it stays within this kind of Arcadian dream. Mm. Something really simple, like someone saying, I don't think I love you anymore, puts a schism down the middle of that, and you're like, well, what do I do with this?
To quote Laurie Moore, this is how your life changes. Somebody tells you something.
Right. But hey, but in the city... Look, that's catastrophic in the city. All those mm-hmm. things are catastrophic in the city. But if you have put yourself in a rarefied environment that you are not naturally maybe habituated to, mm-hmm. because we're not the locals. The locals have a different way of solving these problems that I was just talking about, which is, I think in a lot of cases, they just choose not to think about them. Like, if I would go and talk to certain people in Russell's and say, well, you know, my wife, they'd be like, why are you waking up in the morning wondering whether you love your wife or not? Just take certain things for granted.
Right.
Go out, do the job, come back, have a couple of beers, watch a movie, go to bed. That's how you're going to survive. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not enough for me because I need to know if she's the right one or this is the right one, you know? Mm-hmm. But then you're tying yourself in knots. But you're tying yourself in knots in an environment that you are not... a natural in. Mm-hmm. And then when it breaks, then you find yourself without the sanctuary of whatever it was that you moved up in that was going to glue it all together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
With no backup plan. And then you're just a free radical bouncing off the trees.
Right. So we spoke earlier about a change in Bovina and, you know, potentially other...
in the Western Catskills.
Yes. Towns over the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
About... whether it's more people moving up there permanently, more people buying second homes, different types of people coming up, and also a big shift in...
Julian.
I love that.
The quote-unquote...
That's my colostomy bag that I had to just give a quick squeeze. Yeah.
Oh, good. David's still listening.
I have more monologues in me, David.
And also the food... scene, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And talk to us a little bit about that and about... I'm interested just as a tried and true New Yorker, but also someone that spent time in the country. I spent a lot of my childhood actually in the Poconos at Lake Wall and Paul Pack. So I have experienced that, but kind of the shift in just like everyday eating, everyday cooking, you know, versus the city versus moving to...
You mean in terms of stuff that you can actually buy from places as opposed to what we're doing in our homes?
I want to know about all of that. But, right. You know, also, we talked about this shift over the past 2 or 3 years. You know, more people being in a location at some point is going to start to translate into more food options or more people wanting to create food for the new people that are arriving.
Yeah, kind of. Or for the weekenders, at least. Or for those people. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really simple thing. For the couple of restaurants that have started up, the 2 or 3, 4 restaurants that have started up over the past 3 or 4 years, it's a weekend business because, you know, the whole farm-to-table movement... that whole farm-to-table movement is predicated upon, of course, local produce, local whatever, which if you're sourcing that material, local meat, all this, you're going to have to charge such a premium to be able to put it... This is food that a lot of people up there, most people up there, couldn't afford to buy at retail to put on their own plate at home. If you've got to charge a markup on top of that as well, because we're buying it at the same price as you would buy it from the shop. Because these are like small producers who are like, well, this is what I sell it for, whether I sell it to a restaurant or whether I sell it to Bob in the corner.
And I only have so many people to sell it to.
Yeah.
And so much.
Yeah. I only have this many pounds a year. I'm not going to cut it in half because you just happen to call yourself a restaurant. Mm-hmm. So you're doing that. Then you've got to put a markup on top of that. So somebody, you know, there's only so many people, and certainly in the middle of the week, like zero people, who are going to go up I don't know, pay $20 for a burger. That's just like, that's not okay. You know, or in our case, $15 for a pizza.
Is that Table on 10.
Elaborate on Table on 10 a little bit. And
well, Table on 10 was, Table on 10 is a restaurant run by, owned, run, everything by my friend Inez. And I think it was one of the first, one of the first restaurants up there to kind of do that thing. Semi-accidentally, I mean, I don't want to overtell her story because she should tell her own story. But, you know, the restaurant was formed out of a need, not for a restaurant, but for a need for her to find something to do in an environment where there's no work. You know, you're going to end up, if you're a man and you move up there and you don't, you move up there and you're a painter, you're going to quick, or not a house painter, but like an artist, you're going to quicken it because you move up there because there's so much space and you're finally going to have all of the freedom to be able to express yourself. A year later, you're putting sheetrock up in people's houses or whatever because that's the work that's available. And for women, you know, you're probably working in a shop or maybe working in a restaurant or maybe cleaning people's houses, weekenders' houses or whatever. Those are the things that are needed. So bearing in mind that Inez was at the time, I don't know, 29 or something and European and, you know, amazing strong woman and all this kind of stuff, there comes a point where she's moved up there, you know, semi-accidentally, like a good idea or whatever, but then you're there and you're like, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to take one of those jobs or am I going to do something for myself?
Mm-hmm.
And so a connection, some, you know, vague sideways connections to the food industry through 4 and 20 Blackbirds and, you know, just friends and saying like, well, shit, you know what? Maybe I should just start something really basic up. Again, nobody's got any money, so what the hell can I afford? I don't know, this building on the corner of Bloomville, which is a kind of unprepossessing village in the middle of nowhere. Serve some decent coffee. Maybe make a sandwich. Like, no background in the food industry or whatever, but like, I think I know how to make a sandwich that I would like to eat, so I can't be the only person who would want to eat the sandwich. You know, there must be somebody else who wants to eat it too. And it kind of grew out of a need for her to have that identity and to have a job. And to have a job that didn't require being on your hands and knees with a scrubbing brush, you know? And that developed fairly quickly because she had an idea in the beginning because we had lots of friends up there who were doing cool things, who were growing cool things, who were experts on some kind of mushroom or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of weird freaks up there who really have arcane knowledge about shit, but have never... It's never been galvanized into... you just go around to their house and you're like, oh my God, you do this? And they're like, yeah, I just kind of do it for myself. So she was able to become a kind of lightning rod for people to come out and a set of skills and a set of growing producers, all that kind of stuff, to put that all on the table in the middle of that. And it kind of caught fire. Because partly, I think, and I go, hey, I don't want to overtell her story, but I think even from an outside perspective, I think part of the reason that it caught fire was partly its apparent futility. I think people are very, you know, good ideas are very, really good ideas are really, really close to being really bad ideas.
Mm.
Ideas that are around somewhere in the middle that anybody would think, you know, an idea that your bank manager would think is a good idea is probably not that good an idea. You know, the really good ideas are like right there at the, you know, where good idea meets bad idea.
Like an asymptotic, like where...
What was that? Asymptotic?
Like an asymptote?
Are there two parts to that? Ass?
And a totem.
I like the ass part. I'm not so crazy about the totem.
But, you know, on a graph where...
no.
You're approaching a point, but you not quite get there.
Yeah.
But at the end of that point, the point of... where incandescence meets futility, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? It does burn very brightly there. I mean, I think what happened at that point, maybe when I was a little bit involved too, is within that futility, there was nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Just nothing. You hadn't acquired anything. There was no heat. You know, there was no heating system in the building. There was no... I mean, there's just nothing to lose. And so when you're in that crucible, and there's two or three of you in that crucible where you're like... well, we can tell any story. We can burn as brightly as we want to burn. That is incandescent.
Mm.
And as soon as you become incandescent, as soon as you start laughing hard, and as soon as you start like skipping around, and people driving by, I don't mean literally people driving by, but, you know, people moving past your life, look across and they're like, whatever it is those people over there are doing, I kind of want to do something like that. Or I want to, I mean, there is that. There's a whole bunch of people who are like, why can't I start a restaurant or whatever? But also,
and then sometimes they do.
Right. But then also people just start turning up. They're like, I don't know what your sandwich is. And maybe you only have two sandwiches. And maybe I've eaten it 10 times over here. But you know what? It's kind of fun to be around an energy where you guys look like you're loving the journey that you're on. Not necessarily that you're loving the food, or there was nothing to do with, you know, that stuff that annoys me a little bit about the food industry down here, about it being about the food. It was just about the love. It was just about, if there'd been another activity to do, I don't know, that paid some money, being in a play, being professional ping pong players, I don't know. If you could have done that and got people to come by and give you $8 for what you did, we would have done that. The point was the love.
There is that ping pong bar in Oneonta, if you just drive a little further, right?
There is?
You know, where you fire the ping pong balls
out of your vagina.
Yes.
Yes. Well, you.
You don't have.
I, of course, can't. I know, and that's one of my major regrets, actually. What?
I took us on that tangent, but let me just bring that back a little bit.
Yeah.
People were, and I've been going up there for 4 years now.
Oh, is that only 4 years?
I think it's been about 4 years.
I feel like I've known you a lifetime, Kim.
Kim's probably one of those new people that you were referring to in a way.
Well, I was one of the people that was driving by, I looked in and I started coming in, and it became a place where people gathered, and it was clear it was about the energy. And that's what attracted me to it. And you guys just look like you were having the most fun. But, you know, in the intervening years since I've been coming up, whether driving or taking the bus.
Are you about to say less so now?
No. I mean, you hear about people and, you know, I know you experience this, who want to book the B&B upstairs during the off days booking weekends in advance because they've heard about the food and they're coming because of the food.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is about the food now.
Of course.
For better or for worse.
Well, it's not. Well, it's partly about the food, but I would take issue with that a little bit, because I actually still think there's a thing that I've noticed. Which
I guess what I'm saying is people that I meet down here who have heard about it. But we're also in a particular milieu of the.
Yeah,
food scene in New York City.
Yeah, but there's an evolution to the food. You know, I mean, part of the reason that I even heard about it at all is because, you know, fairly quickly on the back of lighting of extremely unlikely light in the dark. You know, you're flying over in a plane. You're like, what the hell is that? We could have done this in Brooklyn and it would have been eclipsed in a second. Nobody would have noticed because there's 1,000 other people doing exactly the same thing. So it's just a wall of light underneath you when you're on the plane. You're flying over the darkness and you see this thing, you're like, well, I gotta go there. So we had that. So fairly quickly on the back of that, of course, the press become interested. Because people have got to find stories to fill stupid magazines full of junk, you know?
We hate those darn magazines.
Come on. Come on. There's like waves and waves of trivial product that needs to be... There's a trivial dinosaur that has a big diet that needs a big appetite.
There's also a need. There's, you know, I think we're so inclined to be like, oh, the Hamptons, that's over. You know, oh, Montauk, it's already over. And we need to be on to the next thing. We don't want to be the only person there. But we don't want everyone there.
Okay.
So that's what people are searching for, I think. And that potentially is kind of the situation that you're describing in one way or another.
Right. So you've got the New York Times, first of all, you know, they come up, they're wandering around looking for someone. They're like, oh, so this thing goes on. And then suddenly it's Martha Stewart Living. Then it's Condé Nast Traveler. And, you know, they're all, you know, thank God for them, because the place would never have survived without their advocacy. But they are like, you know, they all flock over here and then they all flock over here, and we can watch, like, when we've gone off the boil a little bit, they all move over here or whatever. But it was really, really beneficial. So in the end, you're right. What they report about has to be, they can give hints to the fact that there's a there's a magic going on. Mm. But how do you write that down on columns of stuff right. that's in a food yeah. magazine or a travel magazine?
Go for the vibe.
Yeah, you've got a bunch of ladies in Des Moines who want to read about the chicken pot pie or whatever the fuck it is. So they have to do it in that way. So inevitably, that's going to end up with your person that's receiving that information mm. being like, oh, I went because of the food. The truth is that the ingredients that go into dumping that food on the table, and let's face it, it's pizza. I mean, Ines is like a wonderful pizza order, but let's not, this whole thing of like who's doing the best pizza, it's like a disc of carbohydrate with some stuff on top of it.
Are they going to? Roberta's.
Oh, we're not allowed to say it.
Roberta's, please let us out.
You're actually breaking the plate glass window right
you,
now.
You know
the
what,
lady with the check in her teeth.
Just so you know, Roberta, what you've through. Got out there is a whole lot of carbohydrate and some junk that you got from the supermarket. no, sorry, from local farms.
No, local. They grew it right in this backyard.
From your own backyard.
Right. I mean, definitely.
Come on.
Right, I know.
Fertilized
with your own feces.
Right, and it's grown in a shipping container here in right. scenic Bushwick.
I know, it's so cool.
I've definitely done the Price Chopper run to Delhi to get extra salad
totally,
greens.
Totally, of course. You're like, we run out of salad greens. You've got to get it from wherever the hell you've got to get it from. But what I was going to say is the ingredients that go into putting it in Condé Nast Traveler or Travel and Leisure or whatever is the magic still. I've noticed that if Table on 10 stops telling its story, and inevitably trying to spin your story endlessly when you don't have, you know, because in the beginning there's a lot of new story, and mm-hmm. you know, once you do have something to lose, which came at the end of a year or a year and a half, you start becoming a little bit more conservative about your story. You know, everybody is nobody likes burning shit. You know, even though we know, even from our agricultural mm-hmm. metaphors or whatever, that you know, you gotta make a mess out of the land every now and then of stuff that was so valuable to you last mm-hmm. year. As human beings, we tend to be acquisitional and we tend to acquire, and the idea of actually tossing some shit overboard that worked last year is tough to do. So you tend mm-hmm. to just fill the boat up with more and more stuff. And so I've noticed that when we stop telling our story, it's a delayed reaction. Mm-hmm. But when you run out of juice a little bit and you're like, ugh, the story's not that different from what it was 3 months ago or whatever. So less posts come out, less mm-hmm. stuff, less singing and dancing, less of the theater aspect of like, this is a piece of theater, because that's what a restaurant like that is.
Definitely.
It's a play every week. We're the peasants dressing up in Morris dancing gear. I mean, we're not really what we appear to be. We're a bunch of like hipsters or aging hipsters or whatever we are, getting up there and we're doing a song and dance routine. And people are very drawn to that, you know? But when you start to drop that and start to think, you know what, it's actually about the food. If we start to think that, that's the beginning of A, taking yourself too seriously, mm-hmm. and B, forgetting that it's not about the product, it's not about the end, it's about the means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in my opinion, a restaurant could have the most incredible food in the world, but if the atmosphere and the vibe that it creates is not good, it can't survive.
Even that, though, you know how that there's something that presupposes that. There's so much emphasis that goes into vibe, almost like it could be prepackaged. Like, well, how are we going to, like, looking at our walls over here or whatever. You know, there's all of that going in. Even that doesn't really matter. It's about the spirit of the people.
Yeah, it's about the energy that's created within yeah. that room.
Yeah,
and but a lot of how that is translated to other people is through storytelling and
sure.
how you frame it.
It's all sure. storytelling.
And, you know, it being all storytelling has been a through line of the conversations that we've had
yeah.
over the years.
That's one thing that is not done well. You know, it's a thing that's for, you know, without wanting to get into some Joseph Campbell, you know, whatever, the storytelling has, good storytelling has fallen into disuse.
Mm.
We've become used to it with Instagram and all these yep. other things. We've been used to being able to like press a button, put up a picture of a persimmon or something, and then everybody like, but it's pathetic.
And then you're celebrated as a visual storyteller.
You know what? It's no different from some lady who used to collect Hummel figurines. It's that inane. That's how inane it is.
That's like literally my entire family,
okay.
by the way.
Okay, but now
they all collect Hummels.
My great aunt had an amazing Hummel collection.
Hey, at least that required them to go out and like find one in some in like a thrift store somewhere.
She had a story behind each one, actually.
But the inanity in the food industry of putting up poorly executed, ill thought out, pictures of pretty shit that is literally just pretty. And we have friends who are developed, intelligent, cultured human beings who are dumping some seeds and three petals on a thing. And, like, you know, it's trivial.
I was hoping we were going to get into this. Actually.
Well, I was also hoping that you would talk a little bit about how you look at this through the lens of working in the photo industry as an agent for years and years.
Hey, you know, when Instagram started in the beginning, I actually said to my photographers, like, we can't go anywhere near that because you're so corrupting your brand by trivializing it and sticking it up on this stupid thing where alongside somebody else who's got their, you know, kitten giving birth or whatever, you know. But I was wrong. I was totally wrong because it didn't even feel purist at the time. It just felt like this would be a mistake. But the truth is, those people, had I encouraged my photographers on day one, they would have been, because Instagram is really simple. It's just cumulative followers, you know. So had I encouraged them on day one, they would have become people who had 250,000, 500,000, 750,000 followers if they'd been in the beginning. They had the material or whatever, and they know how to do the trivial pictures, and they know how to have, you know, a guy jump off a rock or... No, you can't have humans. They know how to do things that don't have humans in them that would have made it work. And the truth is, that would have been good for their careers, even though it's an abomination in terms of making anything when we pretend that it has anything to do with art. It would have been good for their careers because we all know people... And I don't want to be insulting here. Because, you know, and I would never name names. Yeah, I got to be a bit careful. But we know that a certain demographic within the kind of Instagram photography world got to the place that they're at, not necessarily because of being visionary photographers, but simply because at a certain point, you are a very valuable marketing tool to somebody who wants you to promote their product because you have a million followers. So, and going to an advertiser, you know, being an agent, going to an advertiser and saying, you should use this person, their work is really good. And they're like, yeah, but if we use this person over here, we pay them the same amount of money and we get the benefit of them, of a million targeted, really specific targeted followers. They're like, we're going to go with this one. It's the same reason why I don't even know anymore, but I hear from casting people or whatever that, you know, models, the number of followers that models have is very, very important in terms of whether you're going to cast them in a thing or whatever, because they're their own marketing tool now. So where do we start on that? Instagram, something.
Why do you think we're so fascinated with food photography and on Instagram of people? Why are we interested in, like, what people have had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and where they ate, and creating that scene? Like, what's behind that, in your opinion?
I think we've talked about this before, but I mean, you know, it's very easy. I mean, it's definitely a fetish, and it's definitely the sign of a culture that is, I think, or I feel like it's a sign of a culture that is, that's not very engaged in any other way, like a bored culture. There isn't great work going on in other places or whatever. So it's a fetish. It's easy access to a kind of, you know, the photography of it or whatever is definitely a fetish. But even the food thing, I mean, why the arcana of like what you're putting in your mouth, it's fuel, you know? I mean, and it's nice to taste things that taste nice, but going so far up the butthole of so now everybody is an expert on so-and-so or on nose to tail, whatever the hell it is or whatever. Of course, it's a debased currency at a certain point. It is a debased currency at this point.
But it's also about, like, you know, someone taking an Instagram photo of their dinner party and being like, you know, instead of being in the moment of enjoying this party and who they're with, they're, you know, I'm not excluding myself from this. Right. don't get me wrong.
Your camera away,
but right. But, you know, just thinking about the human psyche, why do we want other people who are not there?
Because we're
to
narcissists.
See what we're doing. Okay, because we're narcissists.
Because we live in a deeply narcissistic culture.
This is our, like, the new manifestation of being a narcissist.
We never had that before. We never had easy access to being able to open a window onto every stupid-ass corner of our lives, from where we took a poo to whatever. We didn't have that before. You would have had to find a creative way to express that. You might have actually had to tell a story or sing a song or do something. You would have had to draw attention to yourself. Someone walked into your living room and said, with this object in your hand, you can let 1,000 people know whether you just farted. And what happened? You'd think, remember in the beginning, there's a bunch of people who were, most of us in the beginning would have all said, well, I'm never going to do that. It's fucking absurd. And what do we? And now we all do it. I do it. I'm sitting here railing against it, but I do it. And then after I've done it, you know, especially if I'm traveling or in some foreign country, I need that affirmation.
Right. You need to see how many likes you got.
It's burning in my pocket if I've just done something. And it's absurd. I'm like, I'm railing against this whole thing. But I do feel affirmed when a picture gets X amount of, it's totally fucking absurd. I don't know who these people are or, but why? And it has a corrosive effect. Because you can pile, because now there's multiple ways to do that. So you can fill the little space of real creativity is a very, very precious little germ. And it needs to be massaged. It's like a little prostate.
And you heard speaking of
you heard it fear. You heard it
how
fear
far
first.
You have
creativity.
To go up there.
Yeah,
and prostate.
Yeah, you got to get your thumb up there. You got to work it.
This okay. is a family show.
So if you take that juice, and I know I do this. I know there are points where I need to take on something of consequence. Are we going to stop
soon? Oh, well, two more minutes.
Okay. You got to take on something of consequence. That's hard. That requires stamina. That requires you're going to go for it or whatever. You could do it. Or you could take that moment when you're like, now I'm looking at the blank page. I got to write. I got to do some stuff. You could do a couple of posts, a couple of things or something, and it's gone. And it's been wasted on junk. And you could fill day after day after day after day doing that without ever really taking on the shit.
Yeah, well, we'll be posting an Instagram photo of us in the studio shortly. So just make sure you get on there and like it and comment.
And then the rest of your day's gone.
But hey, the other thing is, even though we are in this narcissistic culture with limited cultural production, actually there's incredible stuff being produced out there right now, from theater to rap music, opera, poetry.
Sure, that will always
political
persist.
Writing
that will always persist, of course, thank God.
So maybe we can talk about, instead of looking at food
photos, we can't, we have a minute.
Yeah, okay, but what what are you reading? What would you like to be reading? What would you suggest people take?
Yeah,
would you suggest people take a look at instead of five minutes on Instagram?
Yes.
Well, of course.
You got 30 seconds.
Of course, it'd be the same thing as everything else, which is you've got to take on work that's a little bit difficult. Of course you should be reading. I mean, that goes without saying. Any smart person in the world knows that you should be sitting reading books.
What's one book that you would recommend to our readers that we can... No, it
doesn't have to be a book.
No, I couldn't.
Not
go
a
there.
Book.
That's all
I just want. Okay,
all I'm saying. All I'm saying is that you need to take on stuff that is a little bit difficult. Like, you know, I took on opera as a conscious choice 5 or 6 years ago when I was going through a crisis, because it was fucking difficult, and because you're like, you know, am I ever going to do? And it felt like a time where I'm like, I can put this on in the house. It's going to annoy me. I don't understand it or whatever. But maybe if I just fucking persist, and I'm in a naked enough state now emotionally that I can actually treat this like a, you know, like Shakespeare. There's a bunch of gobbledygook until it isn't.
All right.
And once you cross over onto the other side, you're like, oh my God, like the secret of being a human being is all contained in here, but it's a code. You gotta like work. And opera is exactly the same. People come to me and they're like, it's a horrible noise. And I'm like, you gotta get on the other side, but it might take you 2 years to get on the other side. And they're like, well, I don't have time to give 2 years. I want to go and listen to another singer, songwriter, Bonnie Prince, Billy bullshit, you know, that I've been listening to forever and ever and ever. Take something on. Like, that's what I would say. I would say take on a piece of reading that you knew you should have taken on at some point. You always knew that you were supposed to read Anna Karenina. It's a struggle, you know. The first 300 pages or first 100 pages are really, really difficult. But you know what? When you find the juice, when you tap into the juice, it's this shit's life-changing. Listening endlessly to Bonnie Prince Billy and Instagramming and being on Facebook is not life-changing. You know, either go out and have a baby or do something that is really going to throw you out of the center of your own tiny little world. If you're not going to have babies, then go and take on something that is scary or that's not easy to understand or that's loud or troublesome.
All right. You heard it here first. on recommended reading with Food Book Fair. You're tasked with either having a baby, listening to opera, or reading Anna Karenina. You choose. You make your choice.
Everybody write in who wants to have a baby. I could do it, but I can only do it by mail order in little plastic bags.
Guys, this is an incredible offer.
This might be a limited use offer. So,
can you imagine getting that in the mail?
You might have to put it
little bags
in
of semen.
I think they freeze that these days.
They probably do. Like, yeah. Well, I could put it in a fridge.
Perfect.
We'll continue this when we come on. The tickler.
Yes, we got to have you back out for the tickler.
Ooh. We'll take a deeper dive.
It's like a big colonic, like a really deep colonic.
Thank you, Julian. Again, don't forget, we love Heritage Radio Network, and you can support shows just like this one if you go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on that beating heart to become a member and make sure that more conversations like these stay on the airwaves.
People might not want that.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Julian.
Hey, thanks, guys.
And remember, this is recommended reading with Food Book Fair. And you can check out Food Book Fair on our website, foodbookfair.com, and find us on all social channels at Food Book Fair. We'd love to hear from you. Talk to us about what you thought about the show and any reading that you think we should be doing.
Don't forget to write in.
Till next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.